Welcome to the Blockchain DNA Podcast. This show brings you the latest in blockchain technology and global developments in business and fintech. Presented by Metaverse DNA.
DNA, the Metaverse Dual Chain Network Architecture.
Hi, I'm Alex Lightman, and this is the Lightman Report. And today we're going to talk about the past, present, and future of savings. So in the past, savings included salt, gold, silver, shells, precious shells, and precious stones and metals. One of the more interesting forms of money were the big, giant stone wheels of the Yap Islands in the South Pacific. And we also had gold, silver coins, and jewelry were actually the most common forms of coinage. And we also had land, buildings, slaves, and cattle, including in Africa by the Maasai warriors. And still today, your wealth is determined by how many cattle you have. And for ancient civilizations, the first financial institutions were parts of temples. Many temples held nobles' money and treasure and were involved in banking and activities, and priests kept track of deposits and of loans. So the priestly class was actually the money class. And some of our first records are financial records and records of inventory, and which was a form of wealth. So we actually created writing in cuneiform in order to keep track of financial records, basically what we call the books. And if we look now at the dollar versus gold, we see that this ancient power of gold. Like, why did the ancients use gold? Well, because it keeps its purchasing power. And there are studies that show that gold, in terms of the amount of bread and eggs that it can buy, has maintained its purchasing power across 5,000 years. That's pretty interesting, because there are some people who think, well, if it lasted for 5,000 years in the past, it'll last for 5,000 years in the future. I don't know that that's true, but let's dive in and see what happened during the last 100 years or so. Actually, the last 115 years. So gold has offset the loss of purchasing power of the US dollar. The dollar's lost 98.2% of its purchasing power since 1900. Gold has increased 53.9 times in value in dollars during that time. Therefore, 1.8% times 53.9 equals 97% of the purchasing power has been retained by gold. And so you can actually see this curve, this graphic here, declining. This is the collapse of the US dollar as it goes down, 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 down. And you can see gold going up, up, up. They don't go up and down at the same rates. They're not completely correlated, but overall, gold maintains purchasing power better than dollars. And now, so we're now going to look at the savings and banking in the 20th century. So this is a graphic of bank failures per year. And the each line is 500 banks. So the top of the graph is 4,500. The peak year for banks collapsing was 1933, and when 4,000 banks collapsed. And then you see another cluster, tiny cluster of banks happening from 1935 to 1939. You see a lot fewer banks collapsing after the inauguration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who used to be the governor of New York. So, of course, he was very familiar with banks and Wall Street, and they supported him. So the Federal Reserve Bank is a relatively new institution. It was set up in 1913, and it was given the right from Congress to operate for 100 years. And in 2013, that 100-year certificate was renewed without any debate, which is bizarre, but it happened. And in 1922, there were 30,000 banks around. Many were undercapitalized. 1933, we had deposit insurance introduced. So people had to pay a little bit, but they had their deposits insured. And now you want to talk about an FDIC-insured bank. So some are, some are not. But they will supposedly pay you in case the bank collapses. And you also have a highly fragmented system. So you normally had to have all your banking done within one state. And you had the first interstate banks only allowed 1976. And we see in this graphic that we have these clusters of banks. So between 1981 and 1993, we had the savings and loan crisis. And then also, of course, 2008 to 2013, we had a number of banks fail. And we will probably have a number of banks fail as a result of these COVID shutdowns as well. So we have a big shift and difference between global savings rates. So if you see that spiky thing at the top, that now I'm a little bit colorblind, but basically that top one is Japan. So Japan has been hovering around 20% savings up to, so in 1962, Japanese savings was about 20%, and it went around from about 1968 to 72 at the time of the OPEC oil crisis. It hovered around 20%, and then it spiked up to 24% savings rate, which is pretty phenomenal. And then it's been going down, 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 down. So in 2008, it came down to about 3-4%. And then we also see the United States. The United States is another kind of spiky, thick line. It's this one right here. And that's started off around 6-7%, and then it's just gone a little bit up and down, but then it's crashed to being around just before the savings and loan crisis, an effective savings rate of about zero. So it's very, very hard to have plentiful capital at low rates sustainably if you pay almost nothing to people. And right now, interest rates are zero. Banks are in the Netherlands and in other places are charging people to store their money there. So there are big disincentives to savings, and overall, the rate of savings has fallen. And then if we look at fiat for savings, fiat currency, every one of them is potentially a bubble. The currency only has value because people believe it has value. And there are plenty of examples of historical examples when the faith was lost. Now, that whole chart there that starts with Angola or Argentina and so on up to Zimbabwe shows the highest daily inflation. So we start with Angola, 2.1% daily inflation, Argentina, 3.7%, Armenia, 1.9%, up to Zimbabwe, 98% daily inflation. That's quite a lot. And you had daily inflation 2007 to 2008. There are trillionaires. Many of my friends have trillion-dollar Zimbabwe dollar notes. And you have Russia with 4.2% daily inflation between 1992-93, when the collapse of communism and state-owned enterprises were being sold off. And in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, around the same time, you had 4.3% daily rates. And as you can see, there's practically the whole alphabet of countries have had this kind of hyperinflation. It's not even a rare phenomenon. So we talk of financialization and decades of financialization. That's a term economists use to describe the growing scale, profitability, and deregulation of the financial sector relative to the real economy. This is what happens when you allow banks to become too big, too speculative, and too opaque. You can't see their books. You don't really know what they're doing with the money in the years leading up to the financial crisis. Economist Thomas Philippon has counted the total compensation of financial intermediaries, profits, wages, salaries, and bonus, as a fraction of GDP. And he says it's at an all-time high, around 9% of GDP. Now, during the roaring 20s, the highest that financialization got of the economy. And remember, this crashed and it led to the Great Depression. That was a maximum of 4%. And if you see these poor husband and wife in the cartoon, they're carrying the house and their house payments and the mortgage and the bank and Wall Street. And the Wall Street banker that they're supporting says, hey, it's all holding up just fine. But with all these people unemployed, unemployment spiking to 40, 50 million people, I think that 50% of all the renters in LA County, where I live, are not making their payments or have missed payments or not making any payments since the COVID crisis. And so we now see all the percentage in that graph in the lower right. We see basically financial services. Look at what percentages for insurance, for securities, and for credit intermediation. Now, all of this can be taken care of through digital assets and cryptocurrency with no human beings involved. That's basically this. If we really get crypto right, we have 9% of the whole GDP to play with. And the U.S. GDP is about $82 trillion, or at least it was in 2019. That's the global gross global product is $82 trillion. And then we have in the United States about $21 trillion a year. So 9% of $21 trillion, that's about $2 trillion. That's quite a lot of money that's there for the financial services that could go back to the people if we went full on crypto and digital assets. So the first period of early financialization lasts from the beginning of the 20th century up until 1933. And the New Deal brought significant changes in financial regulation and policy orientation, as we saw with the banks really just falling off, this whole collapse of all the banks, which is part of why FDR got elected. And the second period, 1933 to 40, reflects the transitory phase of the economy that leads to the third period. And then we have what some have called the golden age of capitalist development. 1945, the victory of the Allies in Europe and Asia over the Axis powers of Nazi Germany and militarist Japan, Italy, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria. Those were the last three nations the U.S. ever declared war on back in 1942. And the crisis of 1973, when OPEC embargoed the United States and the Netherlands, heralded the end of the Golden Age. And then if we apply Dumoulin, Dumanil and Levy's definition of neoliberalism as financialized capitalism to link the fourth period of complex financialization with from 1974 to 2010. And then we also can see that the wages and salaries as a percentage of gross domestic product has gone from a guns and butter peak of 52% around 1970, 71 or so. Then we had the energy crisis, we had stagflation, we had the financialization boom, we had the internet boom and the housing boom. And pretty much, except for the internet boom, earned income as a share of GDP has declined regardless of the macro situation. The demand for labor only spiked higher in the dot-com boom, and to a small extent, basically after the last financial crisis, it went up just a little bit to go there. But if you see that massive decline, you can basically say that as financialization goes up, then wages and salaries go down as a percentage of GDP. You can't have financialization be at an all-time high and then have wages and salaries not be going down lower and lower. So that's your choice. Do you want higher wages and salaries and more equality, or do you want more money for Wall Street? It's pretty much the choice we have to make. So let's look at the size and the scale of the financial instruments. The stock markets are worth about $89 trillion as of April 2020. They'll probably be a little bit higher now because the people are a little bit more optimistic. The narrow money supply is about $35 trillion. Broad money supply is about $96 trillion. Global debt is $252 trillion. Global real estate is $280 trillion, though I've heard it's more than $300 trillion, some numbers. And global wealth, it's about $260 trillion. Of that, about $103 trillion is the worth of the United States as a whole. About $3 trillion is the worth of Russia, just to put this in comparison. The derivatives market is the market value is about $11.6 trillion, but the notional value of these derivatives showing what their ability, if they're all executed and you actually bought or sold, that would be $558 trillion. And the notional value at the high end is about $250 billion or more. And if you look also at the world's money and markets, we see that Bitcoin is $159 billion. Digital assets as a whole, that's all the cryptocurrencies and digital assets, are about $250 billion. And the FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, $3.883 trillion, so just under $4 trillion. It shows their absolute power to influence our economies and our government. And then we have the US dollar M1 money stocks. That's about also about $4 trillion. The Fed's balance sheet, $4.1 trillion. It's probably more than that now. Gold market caps, about $9 trillion. The M2 money stock is about $15.5 trillion. U.S. public market cap stocks, about $30 trillion, 30.4. U.S. bond market cap, about $54 trillion. Global stocks, 84 trillion. This was a slightly different time period than the stock market. It goes between 80 and 90 trillion or so. And then global debt, 253 trillion. So we see digital assets here are very, very tiny, and yet they can recreate and change all the rest. So if we look at wealth levels, current results of our savings in 2019, the median wealth per adult in US dollars, we see that basically when you look at median, so that top number, that the darkest color there, which you have in Canada, you have in France, you have in Australia, you have in New Zealand, the median wealth per adult in US dollars is 100,000. So that means per person, half the people are above 100,000 in New Zealand and Australia, and half the people are below. And the United States is slightly less than that, between 50 and 100,000 dollars. And then you have, and that's the case for most of the rest of Europe. And then you have Eastern Europe, you have between 10,000 and 25,000 dollars. You have Africa, basically most of Africa is below $7,500 in savings as a median. And so we can kind of get a sense of where the money is. And as you can see, it's in North America, it's in Western Europe and Northern Europe, it's in Japan, it's in Korea, and it's in the antipodes, Australia and New Zealand. And then if we look at an asset class comparison, what are the good things about real estate versus commodities, everything? So the good parts of real estate are there's low levels of correlation with other asset classes, and generally real estate keeps up with inflation, but it can be illiquid, it can be hard to sell a property. So as a result of the protests and riots in Minneapolis, in the last weeks before this one, on 1 week after the riots, 17% of all the homes in Minneapolis were put on the market for sale. So it can be very challenging to sell a home when one out of every five people who are in your neighborhood are selling their home at the same time, because there's probably not going to be a 17% a massive increase in demand right now. And that's why basically it's really important to have your city government, you know, have people feel they're safe, because they'll leave and they'll take their tax payments, which are used to pay schools, with them. Also, high yield and emerging bond market bonds. There's a diverse asset class. It can provide higher yield and inflation protection, but it's riskier than government bonds, but it's less risky than equities. And then if we look at alternatives, alternative finance, low correlation with other assets. They have a variety of drivers and return characteristics, but because not as many people have them, because they're not listed on exchanges, they can be illiquid and can be complex. And then commodities have a low correlation with equities. They're a hedge against inflation, but they don't have natural income, and they can be very volatile, and you can lose money, as we'll see. And cash, there's no capital loss. It's highly liquid, but it's typically a low return, and the value is eroded by inflation, as we just saw from all of those daily rates of hyperinflation in Zimbabwe and Democratic Republic of Congo and Armenia and other places. So equities historically outperform cash and bonds, and they benefit from economic growth. Good economic growth means really good performance in the stock market, typically. But the volatility can be high. You know, you may have an overall thing across 10 years going up, but when you want to get it in a certain time of a day, you can lose money. I saw a young man was using Robinhood, who's 20 years old, and then all of a sudden he was writing options, and he was writing puts. And he opened up his account and he saw he had a $720,000 loss. He was in the negative, so he had a bigger loss than that. And he killed himself because he was so unhappy about it. So you have to be very, very careful about equities. Government and investment grade bonds, they're less volatile than equities and they have stable income delivery. And historically, the returns lag the equities. The returns are driven by interest rates. That's basically, if interest rates go down, that can be helpful, because if interest rates go down, the government bonds go up, because they're paying a higher interest rate than you would get from fresh new debt. And then Bitcoin is volatile, but in 2010 to 2020, it outperformed all the asset classes. So you see here, you see in this upper left graph, you see US fixed income was about 5% on average for the whole decade. All global equities were about 7%. Large global equities were about 8-9%. Small global equities were about 10%. And then you had venture capital was 1% to 10%. Growth equity was about 10%. Real estate is a big range. It's between 3% and 12%. Natural resources were about 4% to about 18%. Distressed securities are somewhere in the range between 5% and 12%. That's where two members of the Trump cabinet, they were specialists in distressed assets. And buyouts were about 5% to about 20% or so. And if you look at the average annualized volatility, Bitcoin is 125% annual volatility. So it's basically the price is changing more than 100% per decade. And the S&P 500 is 13%, gold is 15%, global equities 18%, U.S. Treasuries 3.8%, global Treasuries 2.8%, and U.S. dollar to the euro 9.6%. And if you look at the average annualized return, we see Bitcoin during the decade of the 2010 to 2020 had an annual return of 370%. S&P 500 did 14.7%. Gold was 1.2%. Global equities 10.8%. U.S. Treasuries 2.5%. Global Treasuries 3.4%. Commodities lost 7.9%. per year on average during the whole decade. Coal did especially bad. Coal was a disaster for people. U.S. dollar versus the euro is minus 1.2%, and U.S. dollar to the Japanese yen was 3.5%. So in the 2020 crisis, is Bitcoin a defensive asset? And in the future, we can look at DeFi as a savings method. So decentralized finance markets can be much more effective than traditional savings, and they have popular DeFi services such as MakerDAO and Compound. And we have an earlier Lightman report all about this, about DeFi. They offer passive incomes to their clients. So the percentage of buys or deposits that they're exactly the same as the $1,200 stimulus check, you see them spiking hugely. So people just took their check from COVID and just stuck it into these kind of accounts. And then if you see what would a $10,000 investment in mid 2020 be? Well, it would be worth $6,600 for commodities. Be $7,000 for yen. It would be in the Malaysian ringgit. It would be 7,400. Euro at 8,000. Silver 8,000. Gold 8,000. Euro 8,000. Silver 8,000. Gold 9.9. So about 10,000. So gold is maintained. Didn't go up much. Didn't lose much. The yuan about 10,000. Pretty stable. U.S. dollar index 10,000.7. Bonds 12,000. S&P 500 25. But at Bitcoin would be, if you put $10,000 into it in mid-2010, that would be worth $201,553,333. That's a hell of a return. That's the greatest return of all time for the decade. And I predicted in the mid-decade that it would be the best performing investment of the decade. It was pretty easy to see back then, but still it was predictably good. And then if we look into the future, we see billionaire Tim Draper is investing in DeFi money markets, DAO, Digital Autonomous Organization. And the DMM protocol, as an example, is a bridge between Ethereum digital assets and real world assets. And according to their announcement of the company, the DMM protocol is an interface that lets anyone earn 6.25% versus zero for many bank accounts, backed by real world assets. And it's a pretty interesting option. So if we look at the evolution of money, we see barter to gold, to metal coins, to paper money, to plastic cards, to electronic money, to cryptocurrency. It's part of the whole evolution of money. And then finally, last slide of this Lightman report, crypto works when there's war, instability, and chaos. We've seen that. So Bitcoin helped people survive in Venezuela and Zimbabwe. And people use crypto to overcome currency and capital controls in times of volatility in the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And in 2020, the whole world is becoming a big chaos zone. Peter Zeihan in his books has predicted this whole collapse of the world order. And crypto has a great chance to become the last argument of kings. Of course, armaments is what used to be the last argument of kings. But crypto can be that for savings in turbulent times when the global order could be rewritten and states could be falling right and left. And as they said from my previous favorite show, Game of Thrones, Tyrion said just now, kings are dying like flies. So I hope that you've enjoyed this summary of the past, present, and future of savings, and that you give a try. Put some money into a DeFi account and tell me how it goes. Thank you for your time, and I'll see you in a future Lightman Report.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.
Welcome, everybody, at the interview of the Lightman Report on savings, past, present, and future. A very interesting subject these days, as the banks hardly give you anything for giving your money and holding your dollars and your euros. So what are you going to do? Are you going to flee to the stock market? Are you going to buy property? What are you going to do with your money when it only becomes less? So we see a lot of historic facts in your report, Alex. It's a lot of development. I think that crypto already gives a higher level of service in transactions right now. I mean, a transaction takes like a second. There's no bank in regular fiat trading or Forex that can put that on the market. So what would you consider points for a consumer to watch for in this new area?
Eric, are you addressing that to Eric or to me?
Yeah, well, Eric, you can go first. What do you see consumers looking for? What should they be looking for?
I think more of investors. So, I mean, consumers, they need to spend more money because they're because the banks are printing more. So if you don't spend now, then your purchasing power is going to decrease. So for consumers, advice is, yeah, spend your money. Well, for investors, it's kind of shaky on the fiat front, because again, the government keep printing fiat money. You have more and more US dollars or any other government print backed notes. So what kind of asset do you want to invest into? I think in the Alex Lemon report, Alex said it well. If you pack with S&P 500, you're gonna be doing very well. But if you do Bitcoin, it will be even greater, right? Bitcoin probably is the best investment instrument ever for the past 10 years. And what I believe is, if you're an investor, now you have an even better opportunity, because nowadays, not only Bitcoin, you're going to have a basket of different crypto assets, or we can call it digital assets, to invest into. There will be Bitcoin like a digital currency, and there will be like stock like STO type of a digital asset, and they also will have NFT like digital art. So to me, if you're investor looking for alternative investment, actually I don't want to say alternative investment. I think you should put more money than before into the crypto asset. That's how I see it.
Alex, if you listen to what Eric's got to say on, I already thought an interesting point. You said consumers, no consumer spent. We're talking investors. I think it's one of the first points that's different. The banks, the regular banks that take your dollars and your euros into savings accounts, see you as a consumer and not as an investor, unless you maybe bring heaps of money and go into the funds that they fill with all sorts of assets. That's already a major difference, I think, that we see people go into crypto assets or digital assets rather as an investor. So Alex, what do you think that investors should look for when they try to create a better portfolio with going into digital assets?
Well, let me say up front, Anamika, thank you for the idea of the structure of the past, present, and future of savings. And the next three Lightman reports are all based on your structure, and I've gotten good compliments for it. So thank you for that.
I really appreciate it. And well, the first thing I think of is the fact that they're in a world that's supposedly capitalist, half the people in the world don't have bank accounts, you know, where the world is seriously underbanked. And because bank accounts are sometimes identity and they're the basis of getting loans for getting houses, getting vehicles, which some people need for their jobs. I think that this is a problem. And then if you look at the banks, you go, well, why aren't you doing more for that? And the banks will tell you, if you push them, that they have to pay $200 per person for the cost of regulating, just dealing with compliance before they ever make a penny on someone. So they frankly don't want small customers. So banks are just fine, even though they get money from the public all the time. Like they've been hogs at the trough with the money, the supposedly COVID money. And they don't really need it. They're not suffering like other people because you can do online banking. You don't have to go into a branch. And I think that we've seen, as Eric said, that Bitcoin is a wonderful investment. So sort of the first advantage of crypto over all other assets is capital gains. It could grow faster at the underlying value. The original price for Bitcoin when Hal Finney was starting to play with it was a thousand. So in 2009, the price of Bitcoin was $1,300 to a dollar, which is the number of World of Warcraft gold to the dollar. When I looked at it, it's basically game money. And then that when that went to $8,000, that's 100,000,000% return. So that's a pretty big thing. So that's the first advantage. And then the next advantage is to be able to wire something. There are people who have wired $1 billion worth of crypto and paid a $30 or so, give or take $10 fee. That's amazing. Now, some people have paid for a cup of coffee or a pizza with a $30 fee. Bitcoin is like Rain Man in the movie Rain Man, played by Dustin Hoffman, when his supposed brother, played by Tom Cruise, said, how much is that candy bar? About $100. How much is that car? About $100. So with Bitcoin, it doesn't, you know, and other things, they just have their fee and they don't care what the amount is. That's pretty interesting for people who want to move big money and they also want to move it fast without any intermediary holding on to it to kite the funds, to basically, you know, use the funds and loan them out longer and stuff. Getting rid of intermediaries is a wonderful thing. So that's a second advantage. Now, in 2020, we come up upon the third big advantage of crypto, which is vastly higher rates of interest and passive income. So as we were starting this conversation in our warm-up between the three of us before we started recording, we were talking about what's passive income. And so crypto has two main sources of passive income. And passive income would be not counting the increase of the underlying asset. So let's just say that the ETH or BTC or DNA or anything is staying at the same price. What's the value on that? Well, one is that there are people who will loan you money for that. I mean, they will pay you an interest rate. And so you can get as much as 25% interest, passive income. And the second big source of passive income is airdrops. And so airdrops are regulated different places. I'm not, you have to check with the specific laws and regulations, but you can get a double win of passive income if you get a high rate of interest. And there are many people who have their money at negative rates of interest. In other words, you keep your money there and they're taking out money away from it. And you go back in a year and you have less money than you put into it to begin with. Well, imagine that you could have a 25% interest rate. That builds up pretty quickly. I mean, that's something where you double your money if you could keep it every 2.5 years. You know, the rule is 70 divided by that number. So let's say 3 years or so, you'd have more than doubled your money. And then if you have airdrops, and there are some cryptocurrencies that give you daily airdrops, that's a big passive income, and that can give you 50% or more return. And then if you add in a little bit of capital gains on that, which is probable because we're going to be seeing the whole crypto sector going from being between 200 and 300 billion to, I think in this decade, between somewhere in the area of 10 trillion. So there's going to be a rising tide lifting all boats from that. That's quite a good value proposition.
If you talk about the growth, which is enormous, but if you know exponential, going looking to the past again, exponentially, it's quite reasonable. Eric, how do you see it that we can have fast adoption of that mainstream? I would say getting digital assets and getting more out of your money, basically, or your assets than you would get in a traditional way. How do we move to fast adoption?
Well, I think better products a little advertisement. I think DN is a better product than Bitcoin, if you talk about digital currency or digital assets. So I got a few compliments past few weeks that people download our Metaverse Lite wallet and they transfer tokens, DNA tokens, and it arrived to the counterparty in seconds. And they said, wow, I can get money in seconds. And it doesn't matter you're in Russia and I'm in the United States. It's just amazing. I say, yeah, sure. Now you're talking about DNA. Think about if we have US digital US dollar, or say USDT or some other stable coin, right? So you can easily transfer value or even digital art, like in seconds. So a better product will trigger vast adoption. And people think the Lite wallet is really good to use, right? So
I think you had already a valid point. It needs to be fast. We're not used to waiting anymore in today's society. Everything needs to be fast. You know, the span of patience is reduced over, you know, the digital developments that we've seen over the last 30 years. So it's only logical that we demand instant service. Like, we want instant packages when we order online. We want everything now, in the minute.
Exactly. The other thing, Alex just mentioned that if you have a large amount of money wants to transfer, digital currency is a good way. But on the flip side, if you have a small amount, let's say I just want to wire you like 70 cents, but you go to bank for 70 cents, a bank draft costs you $7, you know? You might well spend like $7 for a transaction fee just to wire 70 cents. Then you stop doing it. That's a transaction that lost. So if you adopt a digital way of doing things, blockchain way of doing things, then you can send out like vast amount of transactions. Like, say I want to send to 100 people, let's say I want to airdrop to my community 70 cents each. I can send to 1,000 people in a second, and with very minimal cost.
You mentioned there another point that I see in recent months, that people go from fiat into something like DNA or ETP coin in Metaverse. They transfer it to the wallet on the other side of the world, and that person will go on an exchange and makes fiat out of it again, which is way cheaper as sending the fiat from one end to the world of the other, because they charge you $50 for that. No matter what the amount is, you know, the cheapest rate that I see in that is like 15 euros for a transfer. And as it goes above a certain amount, it takes a percentage. So it's even cheaper to take two fees at the front and the back end in going into crypto and going out of it, because maybe you need to pay the rent in local fiat currency. I mean, that's not changeable. I think as soon as people discover this, a lot of the international traffic will go over this way. First of all, because the money's there instantly, and most crypto to cash organizations who go to fiat will do it in the same day. So it makes it not even faster. Even with that hop in between, it's already cheaper than a fiat transaction in a bank account. So you see a lot of developments in there. You mentioned a very interesting point there, Eric, in the passive income creation, and that's stable coins. I can imagine if I'm an investor or I have like assets I don't need to use for food or for housing or that sort of thing, that I want a little bit more of, well, staying away from the volatility that's still, you know, Bitcoin has no regulatory things like a Ministry of Finance or a government that says, I'm going to manually twist the whole situation. It's as the market is. It's completely honest and transparent. So I can imagine that there are some people who say, I would rather have a little less passive income and go towards the direction of a stablecoin. How do you see the future of those stablecoins?
I like stablecoin because arguably, Bitcoin was the best performing asset class for the past 10 years. But there's no guarantee that it will continue its the way, although I strongly believe that. But a lot of people, they probably will stop playing, what's the word, capital gain on Bitcoin. They say, I don't want capital gain on Bitcoin anymore. I'd rather have passive income, meaning give me 1% every month, so maybe 10% every year. So any income, this is the passive income kind of. It's interesting that in Chinese language, the taxation, the word for taxation and sleep sound the same. So yes, the sound is the same. So basically people say after tax income or say after sleep income, they sound the same thing. So passive income is after sleep income. So you can go to sleep and your money still make money for you. I think that's a better definition. Actually, Chinese people aren't really smart on this one. So passive income is after sleep income.
After sleep income.
So some investors don't want to play on the capital gain part of the they can play on, you know, passive income.
I think, you know, for a lot of very regular situations, like, you know, wanting to send your kids to university, wanting all sorts of things that you do want to make money on it, but you don't want to run in a lot of risk by just betting on capital gain. Alex, what's your view on that situation? Like, the difference that I just pointed out is like, no, rather to go for the more risky situation of capital gain versus the situation of passive income and the role of stablecoin in that.
Well, stablecoins have proven to be shockingly liquid. So it's been the case for quite a while that Tether had greater trading volume than Bitcoin, even though Bitcoin is much better known. And also even ETH, I saw something recently that said that ETH had 400 times the volume of Bitcoin. So the more stable the price, the more it can be adopted for remittances, for transactions, and so on. There's a saying, an old saying that many people haven't heard. Nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. And so if you're, let's say that you're in charge of doing stuff for Starbucks or some chain or McDonald's, and you recommend Bitcoin, and Bitcoin goes to $20,000, and then it goes down to $3,000, you can have one quarter of looking like a moron, and that's enough to get you fired. So the whole thing is nobody gets fired for using stable coins as the basis for payment, and they would get fired for things that are very, very volatile. So, you know, there has been reduction of volatility over time, but in general with crypto, you want to have it be because of the advantages of crypto. You want the advantages of crypto, of ease of payments between mobile phones and possibly getting interest on your money, but you don't want the disadvantage of volatility. And so basically stable coins are the advantage of crypto without the disadvantage of volatility, while still having this kind of idea of sector independence or not correlative assets. So whatever would knock down the S&P 500 or whatever would knock down the dollar, you don't want it to also knock down crypto. So if you keep a portion of your money in crypto and it's stable coins, that's more likely to have greater volume. And then over time, you'll hold on to your gains, because in general, people hate their losses more than they enjoy their gains. They just don't want to lose money, and stable coins help with that. And so if you're having savings, the idea of savings, the first rule of Fight Club is don't talk about Fight Club. The first rule of savings is don't lose money. And so stable coins, you know, are better for that.
I think a very valid point to close it off, Eric, I would like you as a closer to respond to: savings are not meant to be a loss at the moment in fiat currencies. They are. So to close it off, what would you say to that statement?
Well, again, if you're a consumer, then spend your money. If you're an investor, so because your purchase value is going to go down. And if you're an investor, the investor is smart. And think about, do you want to play the upside of your asset, or do you want a passive income just generate when you, after you sleep.
Okay. I want to thank you both for this very good interview on savings. I think once we go into the world of stablecoins with the Metaverse DNA project or some of the other developments that are coming on the market, we'll definitely return to the subject. I want to thank you both. That was really a great, great time we had over this subject. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Annemieke. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Blockchain DNA podcast. Make sure to visit our website and follow us on social media at DNA by Metaverse or at MVS DNA. Till next time.